This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello and welcome to episode 35 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today we have a guest, Brett Lowy of Brain Good Games. The last few episodes have been like more political, less game designy, and this is a very game designy episode. And also is with one of my favorite game designers who is currently operating. His games are great. I definitely recommend you go. I'm going to put all his links in the information on my site. Definitely check out everything he does. And we didn't talk about this in the thing, but Brett is also one of the editors at the new site that I just launched, called gamedesigntheory.org, which is designed to highlight new and current game design theory, systems design theory writers. So, by the way, if you're thinking about writing a blog or doing a video series or a podcast of your own about game design, definitely let me know, because we're looking for that kind of thing and we will highlight your work. That's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to, because like I've been doing this kind of stuff for years and I know as well as anybody how hard it is to kind of feel like there's anyone on the other end of this kind of stuff when you make this kind of stuff. So, and by the way, like, you know, it makes a big difference for me when you reach out and say, hey, I really liked what you're doing, because it reinforces to me that like someone's listening. So for those of you who have done that, thanks a lot. And for those of you who have listened, and it's awesome. It's really, I'm very thankful. But anyway, we want Brett and I, and also Knockfisher, who is another one of the mods at Reddit's game design subreddit, have decided to start this website, which is going to feature current writers, current bloggers, that kind of thing, and also maybe do some other events, like have, you know, I'd love to do like award shows or something like that. And Brett is one of the editors there. So definitely check that out. I'm going to put that link in there. But above all, if you're into the kind of stuff that I talk about, you absolutely should already know about Brett's games. And if you don't know about them, well, now you know. So without further ado, here is my interview with Brett Lowy. So first off, what's your background? Like, how did you come to game development?
Yeah, so like ever since I was a little kid, basically, I've wanted to make games, but I never really considered it to be like a viable, like financial path, basically. Probably like a lot of people.
Including some people who do it now for a living.
Well, yeah. Go on. I mean, yeah, it's not clear that that's like fully left me.
Right.
I'm doing the best I can, trying to make my way. But anyway, but I took computer science in high school and also in university. And I think at least partially, subconsciously, this was to like keep the dream alive. But I didn't really like think about it in those terms at that point. So I took computer science and was kind of like, I did some like internships and some jobs here and there. I like dabbled with web development and stuff, but like nothing was really clicking for me. And then sort of out of the blue, I got a message on LinkedIn from a really small game developer in the city. I live, Winnipeg.
Winnipeg, yeah.
Yeah, and he asked whether I, like, he'd seen me on LinkedIn, and basically there's just not a lot of game development going on in Winnipeg, so the people that are around that, like, know how to use Unity are pretty limited.
Right.
And I was one of the only people on LinkedIn that had that listed. He contacted me, and I worked there at that company for about a year. Which was great because I got to learn, like before that I had only used Unity in like a very prototype-y, like super tutorial-y sense.
Right.
But I got to spend that year basically learning how to actually make real production quality games in Unity and get paid doing it. So it was just a really enriching experience in that way. And like, there was a guy there, coincidentally, who was like leading the programming team, mm-hmm. who had just released a game on Steam as we started working there. So like throughout that year, I got to see like how he was managing his Steam release and like how the Steam system worked and like what kind of money he was making and blah, 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 blah.
Sure.
And it just became a lot more, I don't know, realistic or tangible to
yeah.
me. That could be like,
when you see someone do something, it like makes it, you know, like I believe I could do it because I saw someone else do it, you know? That's
yeah,
very,
exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, like that was really cool. I was just like, well, because before that, it's like, oh, like maybe you make a game and make money somehow. But then it was like, oh, maybe I can make a game and put it on Steam and then like get some sales or whatever. And
sure.
Like, you know, whatever. And so, yeah, long story short, this was all just kind of like building under the surface or whatever during that time because I had the job at that company. But I got laid off there, I guess, like a year and a half ago or more now.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, I was like considering like looking around for another job or whatever. But at some point, I just made up my mind that like I might as well try for like take a few months, make a game.
Right, and that was
and
Militia.
Release it.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, just make a game and release it, and just see where that takes me. Like.
Right.
Whatever.
And you had enough. You had enough.
My initial
like,
goal. Sorry. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say you had like enough like flexibility financially to take a few months off and kind of do that like full time.
Yeah, like I've always been like a pretty, like big, saver type guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like I don't, and so yeah, like I just had a bunch of money, like saved up from not just that job but other computer science-y jobs that I've taken or whatever. Like I don't know. And yeah, I had enough saved up. At least for that, and then but my goal originally was financially was just to pay back the time, the 4 months or whatever it took to develop Militia,
right,
and to pay myself for that time to live, basically.
Sure.
Pay my expenses, and then at that point I could like consider making a more long-term go of it. But even that was kind of like a pipe dream at that point.
Sure.
But it worked out, actually. I managed to pay for my expenses for those 4 months and more. And yeah, I've been doing it ever since.
So you've always basically been wanting to make games your whole life. There hasn't been like another thing that you like also kind of wanted to do or studied or
not really. Like I thought, like I said, in school, it never really seemed like a super viable or realistic option. So like I kind of thought that I was going to be like a web developer for a while.
Right.
Because at least, like that's programming, and it's got, like, the same, like, user aspect to it, like, where you're, like, making something for somebody to be, like, using.
Oh, yeah, and website like, is, like, an interactive system.
Exactly.
Know? Yeah.
So, like, it's kind of, like, dancing around, like, what I actually
sure.
wanted to be doing. But, yeah, I don't know. Like, apart from that, like, I'm a big, like, music fan. I, like, play guitar in, a local kind of bar band and, like, but music isn't really like a super financially viable option for a lot of people.
No, not at all.
Right.
You know, I studied music. That was my thing. I studied in college, and
right.
It's actually a little bit interesting that like I think you and I we have similar ideas about games, and we both also have music background a little bit. I wonder if there's anything there, because I do attribute a lot of my ideas to my music training.
Yeah, totally. Maybe it has something to do with like the structural kind of like nature of both those things, and
mm-hmm.
like how. Like we both really embrace like structure.
Yeah, and also just learning. I mean, music theory is one of those things like where obviously music and music creation is an art form, but also
right.
there has been so much theory discovered about music, and you know, over the hundreds of years, such a strong institution. And for me, that was like a very shocking thing to come into game design and see that it's just like this barren world, and know that like we could have music theory for games, you know, like that could be something that we could have someday.
Totally. That's,
yeah,
I remember that clearly as being like one of the early things that I latched onto, like when I bumped into your right. I'm not sure if it was in your book or where, but I'd bumped into your writing somewhere along the line, and yeah, like I really latched onto this idea of like the Baroque period in music, and like where they had spent this time like taking music from like where it was to a much more structural and systematic kind of system.
Mm-hmm.
And like how that doesn't really like diminish. I think there's this thought that like once you quantify and like develop theory and stuff, that that's going to like diminish the artistic merit of what you're making or something. Like somehow like understanding theory like diminishes your ability to be an artist, but like I've just never really embraced that.
Yeah, it's the same idea as you know, the idea that like people have about games and about how like, you know, the less rules you have, the more you can do, the better, sort of, you
right.
know. And it's like, no, actually, like having good guidelines either for design or for playing games actually unlocks the creative potential, like actually really. And you know, people know this about the arts, like that like putting constraints on artists often causes them, or usually causes them, to do things that they otherwise wouldn't do. It challenges them in certain ways.
Totally. And a lot of art is about like either like setting up and either fulfilling or like negating expectations, right?
Yeah.
So, like if you don't even have like a concrete set of like expectations to work from, it's like I just feel like it makes it a lot harder to do that.
Right. Yeah. Now, so the main thing I wanted to get you on the show to talk about was, speaking of theory and stuff, was your game design commandments that you wrote for your company. But first, I want to talk a little bit more about your company. So I assume cool. You founded your company in 2015, late 2015, right around the time
right.
you launched Militia. Is that right?
Yeah. So I started working, I guess, September 2015.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess part of that time up from then till during the time from September to December, I think 7th is when I released Militia.
Mm-hmm.
I did everything basically. So making the game and also like developing the idea of the company and
in 3 months blah, blah, blah. Or 3-4 months.
Yeah. Yeah. Something like that. Yeah. 3 or 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah. So that was when all that kind of took place, I guess.
And Brain Good Games is just you, or you had an artist also? Is that right?
I've never had an artist. So for Militia, it was all me. And then for Axes and Acres, I brought on a friend that I've known for a long time to design it. And we kind of worked together. He did a lot of like, yeah, like of the initial design and like the balancing and stuff like that. And also like a lot of playtesting and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also worked together on Skyboats. But then for the most recent game, Minos Strategos, I'm back doing it again
gotcha.
Alone. And we had an artist just for... I hired a Polish artist for Skyboats.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only game that had anybody except for me doing like anything related to like graphic design or art or whatever.
Gotcha, gotcha. Does this person that designed the games with you, do they ever come around the Dino Farm forums or any of those places?
No, he hasn't. His name's Caleb Friesen, and I don't think he has been on Dino Farm forums or on the Discord or anything like that.
Are they someone who does game design of their own? Like, they have other games they've designed, or...?
No, we're just...
Just friends?
Yeah, basically.
Gotcha.
We play a lot of board games, like Euro board games together and
gotcha.
Blah, 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 that kind of thing.
Nice. Yeah, I have one of those too, a board game buddy who's not necessarily explicitly a game designer, but like definitely would be really useful in a game design process.
Yeah, like it was super useful to just be able to like bounce ideas off them and like see
mm-hmm.
like, yeah.
Cool. All right.
Things stuck.
Nice. Brain Good Games, yeah, people obviously can go to your website and learn more about your stuff. Your games are all on Steam. I will have introduced you and talked about all this in the intro, and you know, and there will be links in the thing, so everyone should check out the games. But let's talk about these game design commandments, which are up on the website. So let's just go through them one at a time and just like talk a little bit about them.
Sure.
I'll give you my response to them, and I think that I pretty much mostly totally agree with almost all of them, but maybe there will be one where we disagree or something. Okay, so number one, the complexity of the game should be in the strategy, not in rules comprehension. Parentheses, the player should know the rules. Right, so let me just interpret that really quick. Like, so
yeah.
the It shouldn't be a matter of, do you even know how to play? Do you even know what the rules are? And this kind of flies in the face of, like, roguelike spoiler, you know, theory. Like that. Right. So the in roguelikes, and I would say in a lot of video games, especially single-player video games, and actually a lot of even multiplayer strategy games, like Hearthstone or League of Legends even, I would say a lot of those games is learning all of the content, just knowing all the characters, all the cards, all this like stuff. And whereas you're saying, and I completely agree with this, that the actual job of, like, you know, learning a system like that should be in the strategy, right?
Right, right. So I think I picked this up mostly from playing a bunch of Euro board games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because the situation that often arises is you'll be playing a game with friends or whatever, and then if somebody doesn't know a rule, or if the person who taught the game didn't explain some rule, or somebody forgot, or you haven't played it in a while, it always feels like that moment where they do a suboptimal action or whatever, or feel like they lost because they didn't know the rule, it always feels like that's kind of like running contrary to like what the game is trying to be. Like, there's a lot of ways to be good at a game and like engage with the system and have fun with it that are not just like learning what the rules are. Like, and that's kind of what I think of as strategy. Like, I feel like you have to know most, at least, and ideally all the rules to even like have a strategy, really.
Yeah, formally speaking, you probably need to know all of the rules in order to form a strategy, because if you form a strategy that even involves like 99% of the rules, that 1% might be like, oh, well, then the whole strategy doesn't work anymore. You know, I mean, in practice, that wouldn't necessarily be the case, but just in theory, you know.
The more of the higher percentage of the rules you know, the better chance you have of not running into that kind of uncomfortable situation.
Right. So I completely agree with number one. However, you know Dan C, he sort of would push back on this, actually. We just had an argument about this recently. And so I'm going to give you his argument, his counter argument, and hear what you would say to this, which is that strategy and rules comprehension are actually the exact same thing. It's all information. It's all learning. It's all like these little loops of learning. And you know, so the player learns these rules, and then they just learn the first strategy they learn, and that's just like the next rule, and then they learn another strategy, and that's just like kind of the next rule, and it's just this continuous thing all the way up. You know, there's no clear delineation between what's rules and what's strategy. What would you say to that?
Yeah, so first of all, just like practically speaking, like I said, like in my experience with playing Euro games with other people, I think even people that don't think about game design a lot have this kind of sense that there's a difference there. And like they feel like they got cheesed out of like being able to play the game properly or something when they didn't know a rule. And then to be a bit more formalist about it, like I just feel that learning a rule is a very flat type of mental action, I guess. Like, you either don't know the rule or then you do know it. And like, there's nothing that like surprising that can happen in terms of like that thing. Like, that's going to happen the same for every person. They're going to like internalize this rule and then they know how it works, or they like know how most of it works, or whatever. But, and I think that like strategy is like a very different kind of mental process. It like, it even involves like some like degree of creativity and like self-expression, I feel. In terms of like combining these systems that you now know into like results that might not be intuitively obvious, that even that they arise from these, this set of rules, right?
Like, yeah, you
I
know,
feel like that's what strategy is.
Totally. You know, what's occurs to me about this argument is that it reminds me, what it makes me think is that this kind of an argument comes from someone who is mostly thinking about strategies, quote unquote, meaning things like build orders in StarCraft, which actually are a lot more like rules, because they are that kind of like binary on off, like you learn the build order and you, you know, there's maybe some like execution maximization there. But in terms of the build order, you know, the order of things, and you just just do it. Or chess openings are another thing like that are like that. And so, but to me, those are like not what strategy should be like. Strategy should be more heuristic and less, the further away from being like a rule it is, the better it is, kind of.
Right. That's sort of thing, like a StarCraft build order sounds to me sort of like a puzzle element to that system, like something that you're trying to like work out the best way to do it, and then once you've figured it out, then there's like nothing further that can like push back on you, basically.
Right.
Unless they make balance changes or whatever.
All right, cool. So let's move on to number two.
Sure.
Yeah, we could probably go on for a long time. Like there's three or four articles worth of stuff in every one of these. And in fact, you have written articles about every one of these, and people should go read those. Okay, number two, the game should have a clear win-loss state. Now, this is a really contentious one. It sounds super not contentious, I think, but it's actually contentious when you think about what that is, right?
Right. So this one's basically whole cloth from your theory on like match-based play, and I think the most compelling argument that I've heard is match-based play, like in relation to high score systems, basically, and how in a high score system, it's very unclear what the goal of the thing even is. People kind of feel like they have this intuitive sense of what it means to like play well in a high score system, but I just feel that it's not a super engaging goal, especially over a long period of time. Like once you've set a high score three times or whatever in a game, different people have different limits, but and for me that limit is very low. Like I feel like I've kind of like there's nothing else that the game is setting up for me to try and accomplish, or and also the it's got this weird tension between like me trying to do my best in the game and also like not wanting to set a higher bar for myself later.
Yeah, there's all kinds of weird stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just very there's a lot of tensions with a high score system that just don't exist at all in match-based play.
Right.
Where you either win or you don't, and everything, all the actions that you take strategically are to try and hit the particular objective that the game has set for you, basically.
Right. An interesting thing to note about this is you and I both make single player games, and so that's where this actually becomes like a real question, because in a multiplayer game there's kind of no question. Like people just assume of course there's going to be a clear winner and loser, because they're thinking of it like, well, I need to know who of the two human beings is better or did better, and but so for a single player game it's a more unusual idea to say that there should be a clear win-loss state. There aren't a lot of single-player games that actually even have, assuming we agree that, you know, which I do, obviously, that high scores do not really give you a clear win or loss. There aren't a lot of single-player games that really do have a clear win or loss state, like a match-based play.
Right. No, there are very few, and even the ones that do, like, people have made the argument that, like, a roguelike sort of has, like, a clear win-loss state, like, where you lose, whatever, 200 times while you're learning the game, and then one time you, like, get to the bottom level of Rogue or whatever and kill the whatever it is.
Yeah.
But, like, that, just practically speaking, that doesn't function as a win-loss state, because, like, most people don't even ever reach the win state or know it exists.
Yeah.
Or then even if you think about, like, a game like Civ, say, which, like, sort of does have, like, a match structure, at least, like, ostensibly.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, the matches are so long, and unless I sort of get the sense that most people don't play like trying on the hardest difficulty for them and like trying to like compete with the system and win, and then even if they do, once you're past the early game of Civ, whatever, the first couple hours I guess of play, there's like this huge snowballing mechanics and stuff like that, that kind of suggests to me that, like, the game design is not pushing towards emphasizing this, like, win or loss thing. Like, you're kind of expected to win in Civ.
Yeah.
And you're kind of expected to lose in a roguelike.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's an interesting observation. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, Civ is, in so many ways, it really just feels, driven towards, playing with, you know, like in terms of, there's these right. different victory conditions and like, what even is a Civ match proper? Like, I guess it's just yeah, with all the default settings, right? But there's like sure, a million yeah. little knobs you can tweak and stuff. And I'm like, which ones are the good ones to.
Yeah, exactly. Like, how should I, like, well, yeah, like that's why the Brain Gate games, like, just have a big play button on the main menu mm-hmm. because like for me in particular like I want the designer to tell me what the best way to play their game is
right
rather than me having to like fiddle all these knobs and like try to like pick the archipelago map or whatever
sure
and like warlord mode or like I don't know
yeah that's and a then, big- like I love the archipelago map because there's usually like three or four different types of maps, right? Like not that many. Yeah. And one of them is definitely way worse than the rest, right. like, right?
Right. So yeah, you've just like sabotaged your game experience before you even knew like what to expect from the system at all. I don't know. It's very strange.
Yeah, that is strange. Okay, cool. Let's move on to the next one. So the player should be number three, the player should be having the fun, not the designer. Interesting. I'll let you riff on that one.
Sure. So I heard this first from Sid Meier, actually, the designer of Civ. But interestingly, I think about Civ in terms of like the antithesis of this design pattern a lot of the time. So like sort of where we were. It's related to one, as it says in the description of the commandment. Yeah. So in Civilization, there's this sort of strange tension. In terms of like whether or not the player is supposed to know all the rules of the game, I think like all the rules are available to be known. I think.
Well, I'm not even sure about maybe that. Not diplomacy, AI stuff. That's
yeah.
Those are like really cryptic. Yeah.
Right. So if you program a big diplomacy AI system into your game, and the player doesn't know how it works or how to influence it, then I kind of wonder why that's in the game at all, because the player isn't interacting with that in any meaningful way beyond like, oh, diplomacy is a real world thing. And
or like role playing and sort of role playing right. with a computer and right. and like ascribing meaning to the weird random AI actions.
Right. And that might have value.
Sure.
In an abstract sense, but I don't think it has value in terms of like a strategy game.
Right.
That to me that feels a lot more like a sandboxy type exploration or yeah like you're saying role playing type value system. Yeah, I guess yeah. To make it clear, these commandments are basically for strategy games.
Right.
Maybe some of them apply to multiple game types. I would have to think about that more. But I'm definitely gearing all of them towards making strategy games.
Right, which all of your games are, and right. you know, probably anybody reading this list will know that you're
yeah.
these are the commandments for your games. Like you're not correct. Even necessarily saying you're not even necessarily saying like suggesting these to other people. You're more just saying here's what we're going to do, right?
Right. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And yeah, cool. Yeah, so I agree with that about the player should be having the fun, not the designer. Another example of that would be like content tends to be really fun to design. Like, so once you have a system, and I think like D&D systems, Magic the Gathering systems, like systems that are very loose and very receptive to large amounts of content. Once you have one of those set up, fighting games, I guess, would qualify. Well, actually most video games, FPSs, RTSs, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It's very easy and really fun to design new content for that, like to be like, oh, maybe there's gonna be a gun that like shoots like nails in five different directions, and then when the nails hit this, they explode and they cause right. five damage. You know, like that kind of stuff is like super fun in like a very frivolous kind of fun way. Right. But you know, I guess maybe like that's a temptation. It's almost like maybe a temptation that designers should sort of resist is like, and you know, the opposite would be like killing your darlings, you know, deleting something that like, man, it would be so fun to make all these new abilities or something, but it's like actually the game is better without them. So that's maybe another way that I don't know if that applies to or that's like related yeah, to what
yeah,
you're talking about.
Yeah, maybe a bit. It also cuts against the idea that the player should know all the rules, because if there's this content that is introduced, say it's introduced mid-match or something like that, like there are a bunch of rules that the player didn't know. Or even if it's not, even if it's introduced at the beginning of the match, like picking a character in a fighting game, say, like, if you're picking a fighter that you've never played before or something, the kind of implication is that you don't know, like, all their moves and stuff. And practically, definitely that's the case. Like,
right.
You don't know all the intricacies of, like, how things work. Yeah. So, like, it definitely cuts against, like, having a lot of very different content definitely cuts against the player knowing all the rules, because
right.
each piece of content is a new rule.
Sure, yeah, and it makes the game a little bit harder for the player to learn. I mean, I suppose it's a little bit more like exciting for the player in a way, like it's, oh wow, there's all this stuff for me to like learn about, but it is imposing a cost on the player, which
right.
man, in the first, you know, year, 2 years of playing League of Legends, you will just constantly be getting this like, I died because I didn't know that ability existed, or I learned it at one point, but I've forgotten because there's 150,000 things, you know, like,
yeah.
So yeah, those,
oh, yeah. I play Dota, and like, there's so many, every time I play, I learn some new rule,
right, in the worst possible
whatever.
Way,
right? And it's like, okay, well, I guess that does or doesn't go through BKB or whatever, and it's
right.
like, it's that cheesy feeling of like, well, if I had just known that, then I wouldn't have done that thing. Or
yeah.
whatever.
And, you know, an interesting side discussion here would be that a lot of people would argue that that method of learning, that, like, you know, you the experiential learning rather
right.
than like some tutorial or something is actually the right way to learn things. And I think that's true.
Right.
But I think that it's like, it's also just, you want to make that mountain not any higher than it has to be.
Yeah.
So, you know, because especially if the player's playing while they're learning. I mean, you're playing ranked games for years
yep.
before you've learned all the... It's sort of silly.
Yeah. Brinket games tend to have, like, a pretty minimalist aesthetic, even in terms of, like, rules a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And that is partially because of that. Like, I want the player to know all the rules of the game, like, as soon as possible. And that makes it more difficult to, like, create... like an interesting and deep strategy space, but
mm-hmm.
like there's some conflict there, but yeah, as much as possible I try to like get people into where they're like really playing the game like as fast as possible,
right,
and
yeah.
not like kind of half playing it or whatever.
Sure. Okay. So you have one more thing to say about that?
Yeah, sort of. So like in terms of content, like there are ways to like structure your game, I think, where you can dole it out in bits over time and introduce it at appropriate times to where it doesn't, I don't think, mess as much with like the integrity of like the particular match or whatever in terms
mm-hmm.
of like not knowing the rules. But yeah, it definitely like cuts against it, and like it's something that you have to like battle with and deal with.
Yeah, no, I agree. All right, so number four, the game should always be moving towards its conclusion. So
right.
what do you mean by that exactly?
Right, so, okay. I always think of Dota as, like, a terrible example of, like, so many game design principles.
Mm-hmm.
But you, for, like, I don't know. I think it's probably an example of, like, a local maxima in terms of, like, game design. Like,
mm-hmm.
it's, like, almost as good as it could be, like... given a bunch of the weird assumptions that it makes, like, to start with.
Right.
And sort of, like, one of those weird things, properties of Dota, is that, like, a match could take 20 minutes, or it could take, whatever, like, reasonably, like, an hour and a half or something
like
that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's just ridiculous in terms of, like, a player planning, like, just in a practical sense, like, a player planning how they're going to structure their life and their leisure time and
sure.
stuff. Like, oh, you need to devote 20 to an hour and a half. Yeah, like 20 to 90 minutes into like playing this game, and you don't know which is it'll be. And then there's like all this weird stuff in terms of like maybe you, if you have another commitment in 45 minutes or something,
mm-hmm.
then like you'll play certain subsets of strategies.
That's funny.
Yeah, and it's just very, as much as possible, basically as an overriding thing, I like to have the match be like a self-contained thing or event.
Well,
whatever.
It sounds more like you're talking about uniform game match length, right?
Right. Yeah. Sorry, that's the point that I'm sort of driving at. But like, if you have uniform match length, then it removes like one or at least close to it, like within some reasonable discrepancy, like then that kind of removes like this out of game consideration that the player has to make.
Sure.
And as much as possible, I think like part of the what makes games special is like that they can change the rules of the universe basically while you're playing the game to be like this small universe of
right.
game rules.
Mm-hmm.
And like to me, I think that's most magical or like special when you can remove other considerations that aren't from outside of that magic circle.
Huh.
So one of those would be like other commitments that I have in real life or whatever.
That's really good.
The match like the king, right? Like it's all about this match and mm-hmm. nothing else matters.
And if you consider that human beings tend to have things to do and like it's right. hard for them to commit to a time period, especially for adults and especially for any time period longer than, I don't know, like a half an hour. The longer the time period of your match is, the harder it will be for them to, you know, like commit to that.
Totally.
So yeah, that definitely means that there's sort of a practical limit,
right.
you know, pushing towards a shorter game length.
So that's like the practical argument. And then there's also the argument that like what tends to happen in a game that's not always moving towards the conclusion is that there can be these strange degenerate type loops that can happen where say the most common example that I think of with respect to this is like healing mechanics.
Oh yeah.
In like say World of Warcraft or something. So like where you take a bunch of damage and then a healer like heals it off, which
mm-hmm.
is like resetting you to like an earlier game state.
Sure.
So then that can create all kinds of strange problems and game states that aren't that fun, where your optimal thing to do is maximize your healing, say, so that you can never die, and then like eventually you'll win through attrition or something like that.
Sure.
But that's like not a fun way to play a game.
Yeah.
To, like win, or maybe it's fun once or whatever, but like it's it's not particularly like intellectually engaging. Like you've kind of circumvented the strategy of the system.
Well, another way to an example I like to give for this kind of thing is like imagine in a tactics game or where you move a unit forward and then you move it back again, or like in Street
right.
Fighter, you know, Ryu like jumps towards Ken and then he jumps back, and it's like
right.
literally the game state didn't, like players made inputs and stuff, but the game
yeah.
state is literally completely reset to what it was before.
Right.
And now of course like Street Fighter has like a timer which you could turn off by the way. But like that's like the sloppiest possible like way to
right.
to, and that doesn't really mitigate the fact that game state wise, the game state, you know, actual meaningful game state information has all reset to the initial point. So like
right.
yeah, it's kind of like a good way to express it formally is players are literally like wasting inputs. They're like making inputs and then those inputs are getting deleted out of existence in a way. Like they're not leaving a lasting effect on the actual match history, you know, like
right
yeah.
And the timer, the example you use, like the timer does ensure that the game will end, but it doesn't ensure that the game will end in a way that's like Street Fighter-y.
Right.
So if you think that like the skill of being good at Street Fighter is like doing damage to the extent that your opponent gets knocked out, then like doing more damage than they did to you, which is like the win condition for when the timer runs out, isn't necessarily reflective of like the goal. It's not the same types of things that you might do.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you could literally just hit them once while they're blocking and they take like
sure.
this tiny amount of chip damage and
right.
win with that if like
right.
things
and
go weird enough.
Yeah, exactly. You'll never win like in a traditional way that way, but you could win with this weird like timer.
Sure. Not to mention you could get ties, which I don't know if you've talked about before, but that's another interesting game. Well,
yeah.
actually that breaks your number two. That breaks rule number two for you, because that
right.
a tie is certainly not a clear win or loss state.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not for, I don't think for a single player game that's a good outcome, because it doesn't tell you anything a lot about, or it tells you less, I think, about like whether the thing you did was like the strategies that you employed over the game were good or not.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a tie, you kind of like, oh, it was okay or whatever. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. I don't even know what that is saying to the player.
Right, and I agree. I mean, I think tying in a single-player game is maybe a good demonstration for people who don't understand why, you know, we both have problems with score-based games,
right.
Is that sometimes I'll get a score and I'll feel like I got a tie in a way. Like, there's that's maybe a good way to express how it feels. Totally.
Yeah, I have no... Yeah, exactly. When I play a high-score game and it shows me a number, like... I don't have any way to contextualize like how good that is, especially if the number is like very high. Like it's like, oh, you got 40,236 points. Good or maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. But,
play again or whatever.
Yeah. 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 All right. So let's go to number five. The game will feature enough ambiguity to remain strategically interesting. So yeah. What does that mean?
Sure. So this is rolling probably too big for one commandment, because it rolls all kinds of ideas about ambiguity into it, basically. Mm-hmm. But I've been thinking more and more that part of what separates a puzzle from a game, in a broad sense, is that there is new information added over the course of the match that the player could not have known at the start. Mm-hmm. That might alter what is the best thing for them to be doing.
And is that concept
all that ambiguity?
Oh, because is that concept distinct from hidden information?
Not really. No. No.
Okay.
It's basically the same thing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I use the word ambiguity rather than randomness because like ambiguity can more hint towards hidden information as part of it, and then also. I think people have all kinds of strange connotations with respect to randomness, mm-hmm. in terms of like either it's like the worst thing ever or it's the greatest thing ever or whatever. Just very like blunt.
It's a loaded word.
Yeah, there's people have very blunt ideas about it.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just trying to like circumvent that by using just like an analogous word.
No, yeah, I gotcha. Well, also, I mean, you could have ambiguity from a source that technically isn't random. Like, you know, you could just have a complicated system that's deterministic that's behind the fog or whatever. And
or another player.
Or another player, yeah.
The inputs of another player. So like people don't really like to think of like other players' actions as randomness.
Sure.
Is another reason to use like this term.
Mm-hmm.
But like people don't. Like, they kind of get that, like, it's ambiguous what the other player is going to do. Like,
yeah.
So it's like, I can lump that all into the same category.
Gotcha.
But basically, like, yeah, I think, yeah, so my point was that in a puzzle, basically, you can work out a series of steps to, like, get to the right conclusion. And, there's basically no refuting that was, like, the right thing to do in this circumstance, say. Mm-hmm. But in a game, for me, the ambiguity mid-match is, like, what makes it so you might have to, like, vary your strategy on the fly or, or tailor a strategy to, like, multiple different futures that could happen or something like that.
Sure.
And I feel like that's more of a strategy game feel than it is, like, a puzzle feel, mm-hmm. in a sort of, like, high-level sense.
Yeah.
I don't know. I guess 5 is, like, sort of driving it. That I want to make strategy games and not puzzles most of the time.
Gotcha. I'm gonna start picking up a little bit because there's a few more things I want to get to. Okay, so number 6. The game will reward and encourage skill, learning, and growth. That one sounds maybe obvious to people, but I actually think it's not necessarily... is this maybe another one that's sort of related to number 1 in that you're saying it'll reward skill, learning, and growth as opposed to what, right?
Well, either as opposed to, like, it rewards nothing and the outcome is random.
Okay.
Or, yeah, I guess that'd be the main other thing that.
The other thing would be rules, knowing the rules, right?
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, and I don't feel like that's very satisfying. Like.
Yeah.
For someone to demonstrate knowledge of the rules, at least for me, like, I don't take any satisfaction in like knowing the rules to a complex set of like a complex game or whatever.
Sure.
Because like the designer could design some arbitrarily long set of rules and like. Arbitrarily complex set of rules, but that doesn't necessarily like make it a better game or make me a better player for having memorized them.
Sure.
Like, that's just a very rote kind of skill, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
You just memorize the rules and then you've done it or whatever.
Yeah.
So yeah, like the learning part of that, skill learning and growth, is in terms of like strategic learning and like heuristic, building up heuristic models in your head and that sort of thing, and not so much learning of rules.
Right.
The counterpoint is like, even like in a strategy game, like if the outcome of the match is decided with the heavy hand of randomness, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
like if it's not so tied to like player actions, I would much rather have it be that the outcome of the match was decided by what the player did than something else, basically.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. No, I mean, I completely agree.
And I guess I should provide reasoning for that. And the reason for that is because, like, games are interactive, and, like, I think that's, like, what makes them distinct from something else.
Mm-hmm.
So if the player's interaction with the system didn't matter, I feel like that's not optimal for the medium, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree. And I would say that goes for really any kind of interactive system, not just strategy right. games. That's one of the ones that would be for any of them.
Right. Yeah. Like, say you're going to make like a narrative game that doesn't have anything, like doesn't respond to the player's inputs at all.
Mm-hmm.
Like the same story plays through every time, say. Like, I really don't feel like you're utilizing the interactivity at all.
Yeah.
Of the thing, like you could just make a movie or whatever.
Sure.
And then you'd have a higher degree of like authorial control mm-hmm. over like your story and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, like when you make a game like that, like you're kind of not using the strengths of either medium, basically.
Yeah, I agree with that strongly, for sure. Number 7. The player should always be playing near the correct challenge level for them. And that's another one that's that I think you and I are some of the only people trying to do anything like this, really, right? I mean, I'm trying to think throughout history, like, I guess some of the closest things I can think of would be like Left 4 Dead had the dynamic difficulty adjustment, but that was during, first of all, that's not really a competitive game, like, you know, a match-based strategy game. And two, that was during a match, it would actually get harder and easier based on how you played.
Right.
Which is, I think, very distinct from what we're talking about.
Right. And I used to actually hate this kind of thing because the first time I remember encountering it was in Oblivion.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Where
automatic enemies, leveling.
Yeah, they level up like based on what level you are.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like that's not really the same thing because it. First of all, like there's a very harsh cap on like the amount of skill you can exhibit in an Oblivion fight.
Sure.
So, basically like your build decisions in terms of your character are what determine the outcome, and like if you just made bad decisions earlier, then like you just can't. Like you have to reset your save file or whatever.
Yeah, it's an RPG, you know? I mean, yeah. It's not really, it's not about expressing skill. It's not a strategy game.
Exactly. I think, like, multiplayer games have done this for a long time, like, in terms of, like, MMR and ladder systems and stuff. And people, like, kind of intuitively realize that, like, the most engaging a system can be in terms of, like, a match-based thing, like Dota or hockey or whatever, is when the matchup is like roughly equivalent, right? Like when it's like a good game.
Yeah.
I just don't see any reason why that shouldn't also be true for a single player thing, like where you're going to get the most out of it if it's like reasonably close.
You could use it, like, you don't have to get all formalist and stuff. Like, I've written all kinds of like wonky formalist stuff about this, but you could just think of it like, you know, like, do you want to watch Rocky where it's Rocky versus like a 15-year-old kid who like is blind or something? Like, you don't want, like, you want not that a blind person can't be a great boxer, I'm sure they can. That may be a bad example. Someone who's, you know, a terrible boxer versus Rocky. Like, you don't want to watch that. You want to watch like something that's like a good match and that you don't know the outcome. And maybe this goes back to the ambiguity thing a little bit in that you want the outcome to be ambiguous. And even if I have like a 60-70% chance to win, it's like that's diminishing that ambiguity, which like just from a totally informal, like practical feel kind of level, seems to me like you would want the game to be as dramatic and unpredictable as possible. And so, yeah, like, why wouldn't you want it to be like an equal match at all times?
Right. And that's not to say that, like, there is some value and, like, human enjoyment that people get out of, like, improving at a thing. And then, like, so say you've, like, been playing a strategy game a lot and you're getting a lot better. There's some enjoyment in terms of, like, playing a game and, like, demonstrating that you've gotten a lot better by, like, stomping or whatever.
Sure.
And just, like, totally creaming the opponent. And it feels good. It feels like an example of, like, progress that you've made. So, like, I think, and also, conversely, it also feels good sometimes to, like, totally get wrecked and, like, realize that there's a lot more room for you to grow.
Sure. Well, we're not saying every single match has to come down to, like, oh my God, we almost won and we almost lost. Like, you could have some stomps and some, get, you know, and stomps on either way, right? But it's just, in an aggregate sense, it should be pretty much even.
Yeah, this is, like, all other things being equal, I think this is, like, the most interesting thing, the most interesting way a game can be. So I think it should be the default state, at the very least.
Right. Cool. Yeah, well, we agree on that. Hopefully, I would love if more people would adopt that in the future, more people making games like the ones that we make, for sure.
Well, they're already totally comfortable with it in a multiplayer context, so...
Yeah.
There's some human cognitive... psychological thing I think going on where people like don't want to translate that to a single player thing, but whatever.
We'll have many more conversations about that in the future, I'm sure.
For sure.
Okay so let's see, so that was number 7 and we're on number 8. The most interesting / fun way to play the game should be also strategically best, and this is one that did you take this one for me directly? Because this is something I've been saying for years, like, very loudly.
I'm not sure.
This is one that I feel most strongly of all of your things is number 8.
Right. Yeah, so this gets back to, like, the kind of degenerate strategy thing or whatever, where maybe you have a strategy where you can just heal yourself every turn and deal 1 damage to the 1,000 damage enemy, and then eventually you'll win. And that's, like, a perfect strategy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because you'll never lose. But it's not fun to do it.
Right.
So, like, why would you make your player do that thing? It's not necessarily true that you're forcing them to do that thing. Like, there's this counter argument that, like, the player should, like, be trying to make their own fun or whatever, or, like, make fun out of this boring system or whatever. But I think practically that's just not been borne out by the way people actually play games.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, if there is some way to win, the player will bore themselves to tears doing it over and over and over, because and really you can't fault them, because you told them how, like, what the goal of the game was, and they're trying to realize it, like, they're trying to
even if it's only some small fraction of players do that, it wouldn't it be better if those players didn't do that? So, like, you design it so that no players are doing that all players are having a non-degenerate experience. Whereas I would say, it's most of the time, if you can do some degenerate, horrible, boring thing. And by the way, like, your example was, like, an extreme example, but it doesn't have to be extreme. It could just be, like, oh, playing this, like, fireball card is better. It's just more strong, and you should use it more often. Whereas this other thing is slightly less good, but it's more interesting. And now you have that weird rub of, like, should I do the, like, more interesting thing and, like, maybe lose this match? Because, you know what I mean? Like, and that's a terrible position to put the player in.
Well, and that's a very hard problem to overcome for, like, deck building games, like Magic or Hearthstone or whatever. Because all the time, people will work out, like, the aggregate of humans working on the game system, basically, figure out what the best few decks are most of the time.
Sure.
Because there's, like, a huge mass of intellect being poured into, like, figuring it out.
Not that hard problem either, you know? Right. Like, yeah.
Right. So then, like, once they figured out what that deck is, like, whether it's a mid-range shaman or whatever in Hearthstone, like, now you have, like you're saying, now you have that decision. Should I play mid-range shaman? Or should I, like, play a more fun thing?
Right.
So, like, the game's goal is, like, conflicting with my, like, human personal goal. Yeah, and that's just not a good tension to have.
Yeah. And I would just add too that, like, you know, when people talk about variety in games and different like amounts of content in games, like, to me, the first place I go is not how much content is there in the game, but how much, you know, how solved is the game in terms of like what are the best things to use, because like those are the things that really flatten out variety, not the total number of content in the game, but it's usually things like knowing, oh, this is just the best thing. And it's like, it doesn't matter if you have 100 things in the game. If I know the best thing is this 3 things, then those are the things that are basically in the game. You know what I mean?
Right. Like Magic the Gathering has over 10,000 cards or something crazy like that. And like the old formats like Vintage and Legacy and stuff, like, don't change that often. Like, there's certain cards that are just way, way better. And so that kind of invalidates all cards that are either like equally as powerful in a like raw sense, mm-hmm. or sometimes you can get new cards this weekend because like they directly efficiently counter the incredibly powerful things from the 10,000 card pool.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So just adding new cards to Magic doesn't necessarily change Legacy or whatever. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Almost two more. We got the game should not cease to be interesting without new content. So, that's similar to what we were just talking about. Totally. So, yeah, say something about that.
Yeah, so this comes from when I was a kid, basically, and got to the end of Super Mario World. Because Super Mario World was, like, one of my favorite games growing up. But once you've beaten the game, you've, like, beaten all the stages, the value that you get from, like, replaying them is diminished to like such an incredible degree, because you know what the jumps are or whatever, and if you just execute them in the same way again, you will win again, and there's nothing that changes.
Right.
But I would love to like continue to engage with that system, but there's no way for me to do that, you know, like intellectually compelling way.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because the system's not been designed to function without new content, which is in the case of Super Mario World is like levels. So yeah, I don't know. I was thinking about playing Super Mario World again, and then I think I did, and like it was boring because I knew the levels.
Sure.
And then I think I played Street Fighter with my brother, and like it was great. And I was like, oh, I haven't played this in X years or whatever, and it's like still fine and like ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I can just play this indefinitely or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's like not built around like this constant influx of like new content. It, like
consumption.
It's way more. Yeah, it's way more efficient about the way it does this. And, like, games have been this way, have been not content-based for most of their history. Like, chess and Go and Moncala and whatever else
mm-hmm.
are match-based things, and they don't, like, expire in the same way. Like, they have a certain level of strategic depth, or they might get boring even before that. But it's not, like, this hard limit that is being set by content.
Right.
Where they just expire.
Yeah. Yeah, so to get, you know, the tiniest bit political about it, you know, the whole content thing is a property of, like, just, you know, these are existing in a capitalist world that where
yep.
people are trying to, you know, they're commodities that we're trying,
yep.
and so it actually is, like, super in the favor of someone who wants to sell products year after year after year that their game is not replayable infinitely.
Yep.
Like, it's almost like a planned obsolescence thing, and sure. so, and it's funny because we're going to talk a little bit about the business of making the kind of games we make, but we run right into that sometimes because, like, we're, you know, your number 9 commandment, like, sort of flies directly in the face of the current way that video game designers
yes.
and developers make money.
That's absolutely true. yeah, and it always,
yeah.
There's always a little bit of tension in terms of, like, going back to, like increase the longevity of, like, a product that you've made before or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and then you're like, oh, well, to some extent, I'm cutting against, like, me being able to make another product or whatever.
Sure.
But, like, I don't know, just, like, on a moral level, like, that feels weird to do. But, yeah, we'll get into that a little bit more.
Yeah. So, yeah, I totally agree. And I think that if someone were to follow a lot of your our other commandments, like, 9 would just be the case. You know what
right.
I mean? Like, it would just be the case that you'd have a system that just doesn't really need new content because it's just you've already set up that, like, you've got enough ambiguity to remain interesting and, you know, all these
right.
good, like, rule things that are... Yeah, Yeah, so I think it's good to restate 9, but I also think it's interesting to note that it sort of follows from good design.
Yeah, like Super Mario Bros. Came out, and it had levels and content and stuff, and that was great. And Super Mario Bros. Is like a foundational game, and I enjoyed it heartily. But, like, it's not the only way you can do it. And other media like film and books and whatever already have this kind of content-y thing going on.
Sure.
And games can do this thing that isn't like that, and I think that's worth exploring.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so lastly, we have number 10. The game should treat the player's time as valuable. This right. is another one that doesn't sound at all contentious, but is actually yeah. like super controversial.
Right. Yeah, so like I guess this is another one you could say kind of follows from the rest of the commandments, like even making a game that is strategically interesting and stuff. Like, I'm kind of assuming that the people that are playing are like valuing their time highly and like want to have like an intellectually engaging experience with the game and not just be killing time or whatever. So yeah, like, but this has like lots of implications, right? So on a very base level, the implication is like, if you have, say you have a game like Advance Wars, right? And it's like a strategy game. And there are long animations that play every time you input a command. So there's like content level value in terms of like watching those animations play out the first time or the first few times or the first 100 times or whatever. Mm-hmm. But eventually it's no longer interesting to watch those animations anymore. Like, you've seen them. And that works against this sort of like game not ceasing to be interesting without new content thing.
Yeah.
It's kind of reimposing this hard shelf life on your thing. And I think it, just from a anecdotal personal perspective, like, as I get more into a strategy game, whether that be like a board game or whatever, or a video game or whatever, I notice the aesthetic qualities of the thing, like in terms of like visual aesthetics or like sound aesthetics or whatever, less and less. And you sort of like start to naturally just be interacting with like the game systems, like mm-hmm. the mechanics, and the strategy of the thing. And I think that's just like a natural way that people respond to playing a game a lot. So basically the argument is that if you're going to have cool battle animations or whatever in your game, they should at least be skippable every time.
Mm-hmm.
If the player has like seen them 100 times before and they just want to engage with the interactive merit parts of your system.
Right.
So that's like the like, don't like just literally waste my time by having me watch cutscenes or whatever. There's also like, don't waste my time by like providing me with like Skinner box mechanics or something like that,
mm-hmm.
that like are stimulating in some psychological way, but aren't like a valuable way to spend your time as a human. Mm-hmm. So like, I feel like this is probably the more contentious part of the game. Like, people get that, like, you can get bored of watching a cutscene or whatever. Like, people complain about that kind of stuff all the time. But to agree with, like, the part where the game should be intellectually stimulating, you have to, like, and valuable, like, you have to kind of take the assumption that games can be a valuable way to spend your time mechanically
sure. yes.
in and of themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's something that, like, certainly not everyone, and maybe not even a lot of people or a majority of people embrace.
Yeah. No, even a lot of game designers and game developers, I would
right.
say, a lot of them do think of games as a pastime, meaning like, I actually want the game to take up more time because that's better in a way. And yeah, this rule has those kind of things. And you can also like take this rule about like treating the player's time as valuable down like a pretty deep path, I feel like, of, an example I like is, let's say you're playing some strategy game and then like a random event happens and causes yep. you to lose when you otherwise maybe would have won. And it's kind of like the whole game is like, what do they call that when you like a do-over, a MacGuffin or whatever? No, that's not MacGuffin. It's another. There's a. It's a golf term where you redo something.
Mulligan.
Yeah. So it's like the whole game like got called off basically, and that's like, you know, if the game was 10, 15, 20, 30 minutes, it's like that whole 30 minutes was just kind of wasted in a way, like because the player does not know what their play added up to. It goes actually back a little bit to the number two clear win loss state because it's like, oh, I lost technically, but there was this like weird random thing, and if that didn't happen, I don't know what would have happened. So so that's why I am against like heavy randomness in games, is because I feel like it actually is treating the player's time as not very valuable, because it's like, oh well, you know, a good example of that's like poker. Right. People who defend poker as a strategy game, they'll say like, oh well, yeah, you just got to play like, you know, 20 matches or something to actually get real feedback, and it's like, well, and actually it's not even necessarily 20 matches, like the number is not even necessarily clear how, you know, like at what point it constitutes real feedback.
Yeah, really, you actually just have to do like statistical analysis on like hands and stuff,
right?
Which is like not very similar to like a game.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, I guess you can also think of it in terms of like this commandment is where the other ones come from in a way. Like, this is like if you take that you want to treat the player's time as valuable, that's because you want to make, like, you do that by making the best game that you can, have it be like the most intellectually engaging thing that it can be.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree a lot. And I do think that there's like a little bit of a moral component to that of like, especially when it comes to addictive things, like, you know, when we do have the power to create addictive machines, and when we make those, I mean, it's not that dissimilar from being a drug dealer. In fact, in some ways, it's a little bit more insidious because we dress up these things, which are, I mean, you know, brain-wise, pretty much similar to drugs, but we put them with these colorful, you know, art that's designed for like children a lot of the times, and it's like. But even if you're marketing towards adults, it's like, you know, I value adults' time and, you know, so I think that's an important thing.
To whatever extent they don't know what's happening to them, it's more insidious, right? Like, and I think there are lots of ways that, like you're saying, like with cutesy art or whatever, that's kind of like intentionally distorted or obscured or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's not great.
yeah. Cool. Yeah. So, and that is a big assumption. I like the point that you brought up about how, like, you know, we start from the position that games, just by their interactive merit alone, can be a totally valuable way for a human being to spend their time. And that's not a view that a lot of people share, you know, except to the extent that people say, like, oh, well, it's natural to have some vices or whatever. But, like, no, I think we're saying, like, they're not necessarily even vices. They're like disciplines, or like learning to play the guitar, or learning to whatever, you know, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and I think, not to get totally game snooty about it or whatever, but I think for a lot of people, it's because like the games that they've been exposed to do not show them that games can be valuable, right? Like,
true.
If you've only been exposed to a certain subset of games that doesn't value your time and doesn't provide you with any intellectual like reward or whatever, like, then of course you're going to think like, oh, well, I guess these things are not valuable.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So, so the few other things I wanted to talk about was, so you've made 4 games, since December of 2015. And so that's 4 games in less than 18 months. So like one thing that's interesting to me about that is like, what's your sort of like day like? Like, this is your only job, right? Like, okay, so that's number one, that's the only thing you do. And then do you work like 8 hours a day? Is it like sort of scattered?
It goes up and down based on like the release cycle for me. Like, because I've done 4 now, like I've kind of fallen into patterns, mm-hmm. like the cycle of releasing the thing. And so, like, right after I release a game, say, like, the next 2 weeks are normally, like, pretty heavy into support, like, responding to comments and, like, trying to facilitate community stuff and fixing bugs and whatever, responding to player suggestions and putting those features in the games or whatever, stuff like that. So that's pretty heavy. But once that sort of subsides, I kind of, like, try to go back to this, like, more open mode, creative, relaxed type of day where I play more games and allow myself more time to think and like go on walks and blah blah blah. And then like as the idea starts to like solidify a bit more, and I start to like think in more practical terms about like how I'm gonna do it and whatever, like make more concrete game design decisions, that starts to ramp up in terms of like how many hours I'm working in a day. And yeah, I work more and more up until release basically, which is like the most the most crazy time.
Gotcha. That's cool. I like the idea of like a sort of amorphous. I mean, I have that too, but I just also have like, you know, a million things going on at the same time. So yeah. I wanted.
It kind of feels like a more natural, like human way.
Oh, absolutely.
Than to like, I feel like this like working 8 hours a day every day, indefinitely for all time. Is like a very strange, it feels very strange, definitely.
Totally, to absolutely, and even more so for creative work, I would say.
Right, yeah, totally. And I think people kind of like take that as red because it's like just the thing that everybody does, but I definitely don't think that it's like a natural thing. And I've read some things about like how, like if you go back to like hunter-gatherer times or whatever, like humans have kind of like evolved to have like more of like an up and down to like the amount that they've been working, like in terms of like hunting season or like whatever, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then like maybe the winter, like you're like, there's less to do or, you know, whatever.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I hope that in general society can move into a direction that will facilitate more people sort of being able to do the kinds of stuff that you and I do that,
I agree.
You know, absolutely. So,
Well, because like without the down, like the more down period, like, like if you're always in a production mode, basically, I feel like those are like two separate modes of thinking for me, like being very creative and being like heavy into production. Like when I watched a good talk by John Cleese about this, about creativity. And he was talking about how like there's kind of like two modes that humans find themselves in, like the open mode and the closed mode. And like a closed mode is like very productive and like, goal oriented and logical, whereas like a creative mode like requires like the complete opposite things, like not discounting ideas and like being very open and receptive and relaxed and that kind of thing.
Right.
So yeah, like I try to, that's also like a benefit of this, that I can try to like find a balance between existing in those two modes.
It's really great. So I wanted to talk about your four games, and kind of get you to talk a little bit. The thing that most interests me about developers and designers specifically is hearing them talk about their games, and like what they think their games did well and what they think that they maybe didn't do as well and that they would like to fix, or, 'cause I know that you are, another thing I love about your production, your company, is that you you continue to update your old games, and to me that's like amazing and really, really great. And because again, like these are these machines that are supposed to like live forever, so if we find, oh, there's this one thing that's causing a little problem and you have the ability to fix it, you know, like you should. And so that's great, but at the same time sometimes there are changes that you're like almost like fundamental, like, and they're just too you know, they're too big to make, and so
yeah, it's almost like a different game.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but so I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about first Militia, and what do you think the successes and failures of that one are?
Sure. So I think Militia, I guess from a game design perspective.
Yeah.
Let's see. Where do I start? Like, I think that Militia, kind of like reinforced my thinking that you can have very simple rules and still get like a lot of mileage out of it, in terms of like the different approaches that a player could have to situations or whatever. And yeah, so that was kind of validated. And I guess in terms of like, this is going to be kind of sporadic, I guess, but I guess in terms of like what didn't work, It clarified my thinking a lot about like actor removal, and how that's like the default in a lot of games. And I've heard you talk about this a lot too, but like how when you remove, like when you kill a unit or whatever, like in a war game, or you know, if you remove a unit from the board, or if one of your units dies or whatever, like that's reducing the complexity of the board state. And I kind of feel, this isn't a commandment, but I kind of like, it's like a second tier guideline. It's like, I kind of feel like games should probably get more complex as they go along, because the player's kind of like warming up strategically.
Or at least stay the same amount complex, maybe? Like one of those two.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, like actor removal cuts against that almost by default, like because you're removing complexity from the board. And Militia does this. Like it does have like actors getting added over time, but like fundamentally the game is about removing enemy actors.
Sure.
So yeah, there's a lot of that I learned about. Militia.
Yeah, that sounds like a good, interesting like lesson that I can see that you took that forward going into the future games.
Another thing I found out that I like in games, at least, and kind of clarified my thinking, is that in Militia you can do like sort of multi-step combos or whatever, like have a big turn. I really like this idea of like having a big turn. It's like where you like set things up in advance, and then like you have this turn that's like a complex set of steps and whatever you've like prepared, and then now it kind of like all comes to fruition. So in Militia, like there are units where you can like reset the cooldown of like another unit that you have.
Right.
It's like your axe guy can attack something, and then you can refresh your axe guy and have him move again.
Sure.
And this can make you do like some totally crazy things that are way outside like the normal bounds of like what an axe guy should be able to do, like how much he should be able to accomplish for you. But it kind of like further enforces that like multi-turn strategic idea of like setting things up and having them pay off. And I think it just feels very good also not have things be like so incremental, like where I score a point and then I score 2 points and I score 1 point and then the game's over or whatever.
Yeah.
It's nice to have like a big burst of something, like a little bit more structure. Like you could think of it in terms of like a movie or something, like where like you don't want to have it just be like a very flat kind of
there to be like
the whole time.
Yeah, like a building to almost like a climax, you know. Like, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, more of an up and down of the graph.
Right. Okay, cool. Let's move on to Axes and Acres. So that was the second game. So why don't you talk about the same sort of stuff with that?
Sure. So, yeah, Axes and Acres is like... My game design aesthetic is pretty minimalist. Not in terms of art, but in terms of like rules and such. But Axes and Acres I developed with a friend, and he like totally has... Like he prefers like heavier... more complex, like longer Euro games more than I do.
Gotcha.
So yeah, like you can definitely see like a lot of his influence in the design of Axes and Acres. Like there's a lot of different building types and objective types and dice types, and like there's a lot of like inherent complexity to the system. Basically that made it a bear to teach in terms of a tutorial.
Right.
And a huge... I learned tons of game design lessons from the tutorial of Axes and Acres, and like what works and what doesn't, and like what players respond well to, and like how they learn, and blah blah blah. And it's helped me a lot going forward in terms of like teaching complex rule sets.
That's cool. I should definitely get your feedback when we go to build the tutorials for both of the games I'm working on, because I suck at making tutorials, and
it's really tough. And like I've gotten better. I'm like, definitely not perfect yet, but like the Minos Strategos, I'll get to that in a bit, but the Minos Strategos tutorial is like has gone a lot better. People like seem to just get it, whereas like with Axes and Acres, like I got tons of feedback around launch about like how hard it was to get into, and like basically the main feedback I hear about Axes and Acres is it's really deep and engaging and like has like a long shelf life or whatever, but it's super hard to get into. And like I definitely like I agree with that. So like I learned tons of lessons in terms of like tutorialization for that. In terms of like successes for Axes and Acres, I think it's been the game that has been the stickiest, I think, for players. Like I think the top rated Axes and Acres player is like rank 74 or something like that.
Wow.
Which is just like an absurd, like obviously like the rank in a vacuum doesn't, like it's like a super high number of a high score, but like that's like just, that's a lot of matches to play even.
Yeah.
He won like every time.
Sure.
And he, I think he has like 450 hours plus of play time.
Jeez.
And like, he's very clearly like the best player.
Uh-huh.
In the community. And yeah.
Is that someone I know?
I don't think so.
Okay.
His handle is Alan, but
okay.
Anyway. Yeah, so like it was a big game done success in terms of like depth.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not sure that it, like, it has a lot of inherent complexity too. So
right.
Like, I'm not sure the ratio is like the best. I'd have to think about that a lot more, but like but yeah, like it definitely has both. It's
right.
A good like case study into like, I can make a game that has more depth than a militia or whatever. Like,
sure.
Regardless of whether that takes more rules or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So my feelings about your games. I mean, first of all, I'm just a massive fan of everything, all of your games. But I think that your games have progressively gotten better as they've gone on. Although I'm not sure. I it's possible that I need to play more Axes and Acres. That like mm-hmm. Axes and Acres and Skyboats. I'm not sure which one I like better because I didn't play as much Axes and Acres as maybe I should have. Because I do agree that it seems like it's probably like one of the like longest term, you know what I mean, like the deepest
yep.
of them.
Yeah.
But I feel pretty strongly that Minos Strategos is like the strongest one overall
right.
as a game.
That's kind of what I hope to do. Also, like I kind of always want my latest thing to be the best one
mm-hmm.
in some
well,
way. Like
I think you're doing that.
Okay, great. Because like yeah, like I don't know, like just I don't know, artistically, I guess it's so weird to like just like. I don't know. There's no good term that you can use, but like creatively, I guess, like you want your latest thing to be your best. I think. Like,
sure.
I think that's the same in like for any like creator of anything.
Yeah, you
like.
Don't. You wanna. You know, you're learning stuff, but you want to make sure you're not learning bad lessons, maybe.
Right.
Or yeah.
And you don't want to be like past your prime or whatever. Like,
right.
Oh, he used to make such sweet albums or whatever, and
sure.
now.
Yeah.
They're not cool anymore.
Right, yeah. Okay, so let's talk about Skyboats.
Sure.
So, tell me a little bit about that. What do you think is the strengths and weaknesses of Skyboats?
So I think Skyboats also has, like, a tremendous amount of depth that's, like, mostly been unexplored for reasons that I'll get into in the cons of
okay.
it. But it definitely, like, and it has fewer rules than Axes and Acres. So it definitely, like... achieve that goal of like reducing the number of rules and like keeping all the depth.
Mm-hmm.
And it also I think has like pretty cool mechanic. Like I at that point I was sort of like getting more into the like with respect to like the actor removal thing that we're talking about with Militia.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was working against that in terms of like creating a board state that's more complex over time.
Yeah.
And like having the player like be involved in that and like I feel like that allows for a lot more strategic flexibility
right.
in terms of what the player does. And just like you have longer arcs and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so I think that's cool. I think like the win mechanic is like interesting in that way and like strong.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Skyboats conversely taught me a lot about like I had already kind of like thought abstractly about like hidden information and like ambiguity being introduced like over the course of a game. But, like, I definitely, like, looking back on it now, Skyboats doesn't do nearly enough of that over, like, within a match. Like, you just know way too much about the current board state, and it doesn't change nearly enough.
So it kind of has that puzzle-ish sort of feel a little
very
bit?
Very much so.
Yeah.
And what results from that is that, like, players feel like they should, and they should, like, sit there and think about... like what the best move is,
which kind of goes to my calculation information horizon and
yep.
look ahead contest stuff, but yeah,
very much so. So yeah, like recently I've been thinking about that more and more because yeah, like I said, like I think Skyboats has like a lot of depth in it. Like I think you could be like a very very good player of Skyboats
mm-hmm.
Like just not a lot of people stuck to it really hard, and I think it's because it's like so onerous to like there are different ways to play it. Like players have different ways that they police themselves naturally when they're
sure,
playing.
Sure, yeah. You can sort of play it from the hip, and then it sort
right.
of works in the same way that you can
totally.
Play like speed chess or speed go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, like, if you play Skyboats sort of from the hip, like, it's really cool and fun and engaging, but it doesn't enforce that through the rules well enough, I don't think. So, yeah, I've been thinking more and more lately, especially about, like, what, like, I had this thought the other day about, like, an ambiguity engine that games have,
mm-hmm.
and, like, a lot of the time for, like, a multiplayer Euro game, say, that ambiguity engine is your opponent's. So,
right.
like, they make a move, and that, like, changes the board state in a significant way, and now mm-hmm. you have to react to that, right? But different games have different ambiguity engines. So, like, Magic has a deck of cards, right? Or, like, Axe and Acres has you, like, rolling dice every turn to, like, give you different options or
mm-hmm.
or whatever. And I've been just been thinking about all types of different games that I play in terms of, like, their ambiguity engines.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how that works. Or, like, Fog of War is another good example, right? Like,
yeah.
you use all the time with, like, Information Horizon, right?
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking about, like, their properties a lot more, but, like, say, like, a deck of cards, like, if it's a game like Race for the Galaxy or something,
mm-hmm.
especially when you're learning it, like, you don't really know, like, what all the outcomes of the deck could be, like, what you could draw.
Sure.
Because, like, when I'm teaching you Race for the Galaxy, like, I won't, like, it's not like I'm going to lay out all the cards on the table and be like, hey, memorize these and then
yeah,
we'll play.
Right.
You know? Like, so when you draw a card, you don't actually know what the outcomes of the ambiguity could be. Whereas, like, if you roll a die, and like a custom die or whatever, and you, like, you know what the faces of it are.
Yeah.
So you know, like, what the outcomes could be, but not which outcome it will be.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I'm thinking a lot more about, like, ambiguity engines and, like, how they relate to controlling the Information Horizon and, like, player understanding and metaphors
sure.
and stuff.
And,
all as a result of, like, Skyboats, basically.
Yeah, that's cool. I love that, like, games are, like, lessons, you know? Like, there's a bunch of lessons that we can learn from our own games. But, yeah, the thing about the playing from the hip thing, yes. interestingly, that is probably what... Well, I don't know if it informed rule number 8, but it technically is a breaking of rule number 8, because the most
right.
interesting thing to do is to play from the hip, but that's not the strategically best thing to do. So that player has that. And I have that too. In fact, I tend to be a from the hip player in general, because
I think that
most games tend to just work better that way. But
right.
I always have this, like, nagging feeling in the back of my head, like, I'm like screwing myself by not right. just sitting here and doing the calculation.
Totally. And then games that punish you for doing that more feel worse
right.
in, like, some sense, right? Like,
yeah.
I don't know. It's just strange. But yeah, like, I totally get that. And I think that's, like, a defense mechanism against, like, games that we've played that
sure.
like, don't do this well, don't
yeah,
handle this well.
Absolutely.
But anyway, like, I'm hoping to, like, go back to Skyboats sometime soon
mm-hmm.
and, like, implement another mode that, like, does this better. Because it's hard to, like, go back and, like, fundamentally rework the way the base game works.
You know what I recommend you do is, like, think about, like, second edition, like that.
Right.
I love that model for, because it's better than sequels, because sequels sort of feels like you're reselling people the same thing. I mean, it's commercially better, of course, but
right.
I love the idea of, like, editions of a game. And it's like, man, if I heard, like, Skyboat's second edition was coming out, I'd be, like, pumped for that personally.
Yeah.
That's what I would advise personally.
Cool. Yeah. Like, Donald X Vaccarino, the Dominion designer, recently just, like, did a reissue of Dominion, like,
uh-huh.
the base set.
Yeah.
And, like, it was just really cool seeing, like, what problems he thought were in the base set cards.
Huh.
And, like, because he, like, removed 6 of the cards.
What did he remove? Because I know Dominion pretty well.
Totally, yeah. Like, he removed, just off the top of my head, he removed, like, Thief
uh-huh.
And Spy, which is, like, problematic because, like, it takes so long for, like, a very limited impact on the game state. And, like,
what about,
like,
Chapel?
I found my Chapel's still in there.
Oh, wow. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Because Chapel's interesting. But, like, anyway.
yeah.
Like, it was just really cool to see, like, him. Because, like, through the cards that he removed and stuff, you can kind of, like, see, like, what type of system he's trying to make and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I just think it's a really good idea to, in general, to be able to remove mechanics from your game, because
absolutely
think, like, help you refine the thing.
And that's a whole other interesting discussion. But like, you know, but board game designers issuing second editions is like this extra level of contention that we don't get as digital designers. Like, we can pretty much do that. And people might complain a little bit. I've actually heard people say things like, for Oro, because we changed Oro so much post-release, I've heard people say like, you should make it of like all the past versions like available like in a menu or something.
Right.
Which is like kind of ridiculous, but also, you know, not nearly as bad as what board game developers get for changing their components and their rules and stuff.
Yeah, and there's just huge production issues too to like updating a board game, obviously.
True.
Like, but yeah.
All right, so let's talk about Mino Strategos, and then we gotta wrap up because we've been going on. Yeah.
I think we've been talking for like an hour and a half.
Yeah.
It turns out like we had a bunch of things that we could talk about.
Yeah. Well, I'll have to have you back on the show at some point for sure.
Sweet. Minus Strategos is the latest Bringa game, and it's based the core mechanic is basically from a tabletop board game by Vlada Chvadl called Tashkalar, and it's about like having cards that have patterns of squares on them that correspond to a board, basically. So there might be like a T-shaped card or something that will have a T-shaped effect on the board, whether that's like killing enemies or whatever. And you have to set up formations of stones on the board, like stones like in Go, to like fulfill the requirements of these cards, basically. I think that Mino Strategos probably, because it has that very strong fundamental mechanic that like once you learn that, like a lot of the complexity, like a lot of things can be built with that. I think the ratio of like rules learning to strategic depth is like the best out of the four games probably, so I think that went really well. And also like I was experimenting with like having a game system that is more amenable to like content. Because like as much as we have talked about like how content is like antithetical to like having a very clean, well-balanced design or whatever, players have like game players in general have like strong expectations about like what, like if you hear that not you, but if most people hear that a game has like a lot of cards or whatever, they associate that with depth of strategy or whatever.
Right.
So it's a way for you to like broadcast that there's like enough going on here without, like in a quick way. Like,
sure.
Like, I don't know, like games will often like talk about like how, oh, there's 800,000 different startup scenarios or whatever. And it's like, oh, well, I guess there's like, like, it won't get boring quick, right, is the implication.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's true is, like, a totally different thing. But that's, like, a thought that players have.
Sure.
So, yeah, like, I was trying to, like, cater a little bit more to, like, player expectations in that way by having, like, this card-driven system. And I think that worked well as well.
Yeah, it's good to speak the language of gamers. I mean, that's something that I run into a lot is like we both have very similar ideas about like what would be like ideal game design, and then like, but we also have to kind of like go back and be like, well, okay, but what are people like sort of, what language are people currently speaking, and how do we like bridge that gap?
Right, because not only is that like financially prudent, but like to make games that people will buy, but it also like, just in terms of like I don't really feel that my art, like my games, like exist, like they don't exist in a vacuum, right? Like they're most real when people are playing them and engaging with them.
Absolutely.
And, like, forming strategies or whatever. So I want people to do that, and like I feel like if I meet them in the middle in some way, by like catering better to their expectations, they engage more fully with the system in some respects.
Yeah, I mean, the metaphor I love is speaking the language is just, right. You know, it's like there's people are, they speak a certain language in games and, right. You know, you can write the best essay in the world, but if it's written in a language that no one speaks, then it's like, who cares? It's totally, it may as well not exist, you know? Yeah, totally. And it's not, that, I think that's a good way to frame it that shows how it's not like this cynical kind of like sellout move. But it's just understanding, like, sort of your audience and the people you're trying to talk to and the fact that art is, at the end of the day, all art is a communication, an attempt to communicate something. And if you fail to communicate, that's, like, step number one. And you've just – it's complete failure if you fail to communicate, I feel like.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you could say that abstractly the game is an ideal game or whatever if you just make it in the way that you think a game should be. But if nobody like enjoys it or plays it, like it's
tree falling in the woods.
Right. There's some axis that it's not succeeding on. Right.
Right. Like, of course.
Anyway.
Yeah. Well, just to hammer on about that one more time is the art is the delivery of a message. So it's like you have the message, but you have no delivery mechanism. You have no way of like delivering it. So it's nothing.
So nobody's going to receive my idea about like the ratio of like rules complexity to depth or like how a game should be a valuable use of a player's time or something. Like nobody's gonna realize these things unless they engage with the system.
Yeah. Okay, so I gotta have you back on because there's a ton more stuff I wanted to talk about. I want to talk about like being, you know, the business that, because we both have a very similar kind of like business thing. I want to talk about like what you want to do in the future. Are you working on a new game right now?
Yeah, I'm kind of tossing around a few game ideas right now. I'm back in the open mode.
Okay.
Basically, I've been doing a couple like technical type projects, like simple things, like I'm trying to get Militia on iOS.
Oh, right, sure.
Is one of them, but nothing too like crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly I'm like brainstorming and thinking about ambiguity engines and like and brainstorming themes, and I have like at least one idea that's like reasonably coherent.
Cool. All right. Yeah. Well, there's a ton more stuff we got to talk about, but we're going to have to save it for next time because we are, in fact, at an hour and a half right now.
Good episode.
Yes. Very good. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah. It was awesome, man.
All right. Well, we'll speak many times in the future.
Cool.
Okay. I'll see you.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.